Mark chapter 9. We're looking at Mark chapter 9 at the transfiguration of Jesus, the transfiguration of Jesus. We already looked a little bit earlier about the transfiguration itself. We looked at verses. Oh, I see several people on the phone. Sam, Sarah, Art, Jim, Sonia, and Reese. That's great. That's great. And Valerie's here. Hello, Valerie. So we started with. We already looked at the Transfiguration, the event itself, last week. So if you are interested in learning about that, you can go ahead and watch the lesson that we did last week on this. We looked at what we looked at verse 3 and verse 4 about who appeared and what they were talking about. You know, we weren't there exactly what they were to know exactly what they were talking about, but Luke records that they were talking about what was about to happen with Jesus, about his decease, according to the English translations that we have. But the Greek word is exodus. They were looking to see what his exodus was going to be like. And he was asking, or he's talking about that with them. But now let us consider the next part of this that we didn't quite get to last week. And that is the idea of Peter's response. What was Peter's response? You know, his response was not exactly stellar. So let's go ahead and read that particular thing, and that's chapter 9, verse 5. Well, let's go back up and start in verse 2 so we can get the context. Now after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John and led them up on a high mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. His clothes became shining, exceedingly white like snow, such as no wanderer on earth can whiten them. And Elijah appeared to them with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. Then Peter answered and said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. And let us make three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." Because he did not know what to say, for they were greatly afraid. And a cloud came from cloud came and overshadowed them. And a voice came out of the cloud, saying, "This is my beloved son, hear him." Suddenly, when they had looked around, they saw no one anymore, but only Jesus with themselves. All right, so that's the passage we're going to look at for right now. So let's consider Peter's response here for a moment. Peter's response. His response, well, I mean, it's somewhat understandable. It's somewhat understandable. Now hear me out for a second. I mean, haven't you ever been so nervous that you just didn't know what to say? But it was too awkward to say to just stay silent. I mean, you know, you're in a situation and you're just not quite sure the right way to go, but you're pretty convinced that being quiet is not the right way to go. And you kind of think, or you speak before you think. And I don't know if you've ever been in that situation before. I certainly have, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. Especially since Peter is one of those people. This was Peter in this situation. He just wasn't sure what to say, and he thought being quiet was the wrong move. Whatever the case, we can see that he meant well. It seems as though he meant well. He wanted to honor these two great men of history, Moses and Elijah. I mean, who wouldn't want to honor these prophets, these great men of the Old Testament? And he wanted to honor them with tabernacles or tents. A tabernacle, a tent is a tabernacle is sort of a fancy tent, if you will. And so that's what we have here. That's what he was wanting to do, honor them with this. Such a tabernacle or a tent implied some kind of sacred dwelling meant to honor these great men on this mountain, and no doubt to commemorate this particular event. How, you know, they recognized that this was a great event. This had some great significance to it. They recognized that, and rightly so. But they misunderstood. They didn't know what to say. I mean, first of all, they didn't know what to say. Second, they just didn't understand quite what was going on here, which is understandable given their situation. The problem, though, is that Peter wanted to honor Jesus at the same level as Moses and Elijah. Again, it says in that passage he had no idea what he was saying. It said that he was afraid, for they were greatly afraid. In all of the accounts when we looked at them a few weeks ago in the sermon on the Transfiguration, we noted that there were several places where it says they were afraid. So they were afraid when they saw Moses and Elijah. They were afraid when they heard the voice. It was an intense situation here that they were facing. And Dan seems to say that as well. If Peter was nervous before God spoke, imagine how he felt after God spoke. And that's exactly right too. And in fact, in all those accounts, it notes that they were afraid when the two men appeared. They were afraid when he was talking with them, and they were afraid after they heard that voice. Sam, I think you got some.
I'm just wondering, when do you think the apostles started figuring out the preeminence of Christ as the Son of God? Because in this situation, two of these great prophets of the Old Testament, and when did they really start understanding that Jesus was at a different level?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know that they knew that by this point. They did know that he was the Christ, or at least they had some inkling of it because of the great confession that we just read about. But we don't know what that meant to them, except that it meant some kind of king, a conqueror, if you will. But certainly Jesus was not what they expected. Especially in a lot of the actions that he took. And that's another good question. They knew that he was some kind of prophet. They knew that he was a great man. They knew he was the Christ. And in fact, Matthew records they knew he was the Son of the Living God. But at what point do they know that that means he is greater than Moses or Elijah? And how much greater? That's a good point, Sam. I thank you for that. We don't know. We don't know at what point. Whatever the case, in any event, we do see that they were afraid. And of course, I'd imagine you'd be afraid too at such a sight. Just not sure what to do, nervous, as Dan says here, unsure about what exactly is going on here. You see this great sight, but you don't know how to interpret it or to put it in its proper context, and it's just happening. So what do you do? What do you do? Well, Peter couldn't keep his mouth shut, which is kind of typical Peter. And so he says, "Oh, let's honor you and these other two men." But that's what we see. Then we see the voice. We read about the voice that speaks here, this voice from heaven, this voice from heaven. We note that in verse 7 that a cloud preceded the voice from heaven. This cloud had come over them. God's presence was often depicted in the Old Testament as a cloud or as being in a cloud. When the tabernacle was completed, we see in Exodus chapter 40, verses 34 through 38, and a part of that says that a cloud covered the tabernacle of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And so we note that the presence of the Lord is often indicated by a cloud. And of course, that cloud continued to guide the Israelites throughout the wilderness. We know that it appeared as a cloud during the day and as a pillar of fire by night. And so this this uh, this cloud represented the presence of God. And so we see that as a as an indication here in potentially here in Mark 9. Peter, hello Kathy and Rosa, good to see you. Peter wanted to build tabernacles for all three of these individuals, not realizing the true tabernacle is Jesus Christ himself guiding us through the wilderness of life. You know, there's a lot of signs and symbols and types and anti-types and things of that nature, but the tabernacle, I believe, is well, at least the in some sense is Jesus. He housed the Spirit of God when he was on this earth, and he was the and he is the one who guides us through, again, the wilderness of life. And if we look to him, then he is the one that we need to follow. This, and in fact, he was there in the wilderness. We read from First Corinthians chapter 10, and during the sermon this morning, and I didn't get to it, but he was the rock that was with him as well. Anyway, a bit of a sidetrack. This shows that the second time God's voice that this is the second time that God's voice came to affirm Jesus as his son. We recall that the first time we see it is at Jesus's baptism. This is where John the Baptist and those around him heard the voice of God saying that this is my beloved son. Listen to him. And then here again, we see that exact thing here in the Transfiguration. Now, some time had passed since the baptism. Some time had passed. John had declared that this was the Lamb of God who was going to take away the sins of the world. He declared that he is not worthy to unloose his sandal strap. And yet, and so it was declared at the beginning there. And then a lot of time passed and a lot of events occurred to bolster that view that Jesus is the Son of God. And so we get it again here in the middle. Well, sort of in the middle here in Mark chapter 9 with the Transfiguration, and of course Matthew 17 and Luke 9. Now at this point, before John the Baptist and those around during the baptism heard the voice of God, but now only this trio, Peter, James, and John, hear this voice, with the exception of Jesus, obviously. They hear the voice of God, affirming the very confession that they had made a week before, as we see 6 days passed, roughly, since the confession was made in chapter 8. There's a third time the voice of God is recorded, and it is recorded only in John, and it's in John 12, verses 28 and 29. And I have that on here. John 12, 28 and 29. This particular event is heard by many others around them. And though it did note that many perceived it or supposed that it was thunder at that time. So God's voice sounds a little like thunder, at least to some people. Not only this, but it also stands out as God giving his authority to his son, Jesus. And that we should hear him over Moses and over the prophets. Over Moses and the prophets. Jesus now takes precedence over the authority of the Old Testament scriptures. That's one of the main points that we can get from this. Listen to him. Not that we shouldn't listen to Moses and Elijah, they certainly have their place. But who takes precedence? Jesus. Then Moses and Elijah vanish, leaving only Jesus and I have in my notes here our dumbfounded trio. They don't know what to say now. Even Peter is silent. Can you imagine? The message to us is clear. Listen to Jesus. Listen to Jesus. Let's look at the next several verses. Chapter 9, verses 9 through 13. chapter 9, verses 9 through 13. And so we're going back. This is chapter 9's. And then Elijah's coming is the... So I'm taking this from a particular commentary, and he divides it up in a certain way. And it's fine the way he decides to divide it. And I may agree with it in some places, I may not, but he decides to divide it, this part. Most of the other commentaries divide it, don't separate this section out from the Transfiguration, because they are connected, but he does, and so I am. So let's look at Elijah's coming here, and this is, in, chapter 9, verses 9 through 13. So let's go ahead and read that passage right now. Now, as they came down from the mountain, he commanded them that they should tell no one the things they had seen, till the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept this word to themselves, questioning what the rising from the dead meant. And they asked him, saying, "Why do the scribes say that Elijah must come first?" Then he answered and told them, "Indeed, Elijah is coming first and restores all things. And how is it written concerning the Son of Man that he must suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I say to you that Elijah has also come, and they did to him whatever they wished, as it is written of him." All right, so that's... that section there, sort of an epilogue, if you will, to the Transfiguration, where they ask these questions about Jesus. So, first, we'll note that there was a secret to keep. We've talked about the Messianic secret on several occasions, but we'll talk about it for a little while anyway today. Clearly, we note that Jesus did not want others to know about the Transfiguration just yet. He did not want them to know about it. It was only for these three at this time. And it is unclear as to why that is the case. Why does he want to limit to these three? You know, I have a couple theories, a couple suggestions. Perhaps he feared people wouldn't believe it at first, and it would discredit Peter, James, and John before they would serve as a witness of his resurrection. Maybe. Perhaps he didn't want his other disciples to feel jealous about not including them. Maybe. Well, then why didn't he include them? I don't know. Maybe he just felt that these three guys were the ones that needed to see this. Maybe because we'll see in a little bit that, well, maybe not today, that there was an event after this where the disciples, the other nine, are there and they can't heal this epileptic boy. So maybe it's to prove that point for these other nine. I don't know. We'll see. Or we'll see one day. Another possibility, perhaps it was because of the snake in the grass, Judas Iscariot, who was there. And if Jesus had singled him out, then he would have tipped his hand. Or maybe the other disciples would have turned against him. Perhaps Judas would not have betrayed Jesus had he seen or been aware of this particular event, and it was something that had to occur. Whatever the reason, there was a timestamp given on this particular secret. It was to be kept until after the resurrection. After the resurrection. We saw in a sermon recently that Peter did indeed talk about what he had experienced later in 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 16 through 18. And John also made allusions to it, as we mentioned in John 1, verse 14, how they saw the glory of the Lord. The glory, saw his glory, the Word made flesh. They saw his glory. They did keep this secret. They kept this secret, but they weren't sure about the rising, about the part where he said about the rising from the dead. After Jesus had just explained to them that this would happen in chapter 8, verse 31, they still had questions. They still weren't sure about that. And that's something that you're is understandable, I think, in the sense that it's not, this hasn't happened before. That we have the benefit of hindsight. They were in it. Since they couldn't reconcile at the same time, they couldn't reconcile their idea of the Messiah with one who suffers and dies. They couldn't reconcile those ideas. A resurrection was still rather unbelievable to them, despite the resurrections that had already occurred, that they had already seen, in particular, Mark 5, verses 41 and 42, where Jesus raised Jairus's daughter. Or perhaps they were just grappling with how a resurrection would fit into all of this, particularly when it came to Elijah's prophesied coming that we'll talk about. Next, we'll see this question that they have. They have a question. All right, they have a question. These three disciples, they had this burning question in their minds concerning Elijah. Why do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? Why do they say that? Well, after seeing Elijah, they just saw Elijah, Moses and Elijah, they just saw Elijah up on this mountain with Jesus, and it called to mind this prophecy that the scribes would, I don't know how often they would reiterate this prophecy, but they would say, this has to happen first. We see that this prophecy is in Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. It's a prophecy that we've already discussed at the beginning of our look at Mark, because, this is a reference to Elijah coming, and it is what we note that John the Baptist fulfills this prophecy here. All right. Perhaps then they thought that this was a fulfillment of that prophecy, but were curious why they had to keep it a secret if it were already foretold. Wouldn't they want people to know about Elijah's having come? It's a logical question, maybe, given what they knew up to this point. They just didn't have all the details, all the information up to this point. It's a logical question. Why, we just saw Elijah. We just saw Elijah. The scribes say Elijah must come first. Shouldn't then Elijah, shouldn't we tell people about this? Why have this secret? It's a logical question given their information that they have. But now we see the answer that Jesus gives. The answer. Jesus responds with an affirmative answer. Yes, Elijah is coming first. Elijah is coming first. The tenses, the verb tenses of these two verses are very interesting, verses 12 and 13. Upon reading it in the New King James, it sounds like Jesus is saying that Elijah has not yet come in verse 12, but then in verse 13, it seems like he has already come. So, Jesus, which is it? What are we talking about here? Help us out. Well, let's consider the tenses of here in the original language. It might help us a little bit. The tenses, well, okay, so verse 12, Elijah is coming first. So this word is coming is elthon, which is in the aorist tense. Now the aorist tense is one of those tenses that we don't have in English. What is this aorist tense? And why do I care? Well, it's a verb tense in Greek that is used actually very often. But it is an indefinite tense. But it's still concerning a past action. So we typically translate it as a past tense. Okay, so let's take a look. The word is coming is in this aorist tense, sort of a past tense. Restores. is in the present tense. Present tense. So if you can write in your Bibles, I don't know, I don't usually write in my Bibles, but if you do, it might be interesting to do this. Coming is in the aorist tense, a past tense. Restores all things is in a present tense. In verse 13, has come, aleluthen, is in the perfect tense, which is also a past tense. And we'll look at that in a second. And then they did to him whatever they wished, is also in an aorist tense, so also a past tense. Okay, so what's the point here? Again, the aorist tense is an indefinite tense, but it's still concerning a past action. And then you couple this with the present tense in verse 12. So the is coming with restores. You couple that together. This may be the reason why they translate it the way they did, is coming, instead of came. Elijah came, is probably how we might translate it. But because of the present tense, that might be why they did that. They went along with the present tense. And why they translated it in the past tense later, because of the perfect tense in verse 13. All right, I know this is a lot. There are a couple things to consider. There is also an historical present tense that Mark uses often. And what that means is that Mark talks about things in the present tense. And we would translate it in the past tense because we don't typically have a historical present. He uses this present to make the events that he describes more vivid, more lively. Again, we translate it in the past tense typically. And perhaps this is the sense that restores we see is in present tense. Perhaps that's the sense that it's being used, that it should be in the past tense, but historical past. In the parallel account, though, in Matthew 17 and verse 11, the word restore is in the future tense. Is in the future tense. So I think looking at all the data that we have, I think the best way to look at it is that Elijah came, began the process of restoring all things, and that work will continue after Elijah had gone. And in fact, that is the case. Jesus is part of that. So I think this is how we can best interpret verses 12 and 13 and those weird tenses that we see there that just doesn't quite make sense to us in our English translations. Jesus in verse 12 kind of throws in there something else that isn't recorded in the other accounts, I don't think. I know not Matthew. I can't remember if it's in Luke or not. But he throws in another mention of his suffering and rejection, and that it was prophesied in the Old Testament. Of course, one clear passage that we see in the Old Testament is Isaiah 53, isn't it? Where we read about he was wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities. Or is it that I mix that up? It's one of those, bruised for our trans. Well, you know, that phrase there. That is so clearly talking about somebody that was going to come. And we recognize that, of course, to be the suffering servant. Who is Jesus? And again, the point of the Gospel of Mark, that he is a suffering servant. Jesus also mentions that it was prophesied of Elijah's suffering and death. He says, "But I say to you that Elijah has also come, and they did to him whatever they wished, as it is written of him." So where is that? Well, of course, he wasn't talking about the literal Elijah. Matthew's account explicitly affirms that he was talking about John the Baptist as the disciples understood it. We see in Matthew chapter 17 and verse 13. So he's talking about John the Baptist here. So this is one of the evidences that Mark was writing to a a Roman Christian audience, emphasis on the Christian in this aspect. People who already knew the general story but needed reminders. They already knew that John was the next coming of Elijah, if you will, had come in the spirit of Elijah. They knew that, so they didn't need to be reminded of it explicitly like they did in Matthew. So that's part of the reason why they think that. Well, anyway, it is interesting though that their minds in Matthew's account, that their minds went straight to John when Jesus said this, as if it were obvious from his fiery preaching and his what he wore, his attire, that this was indeed Elijah, as it should have been. It should have been obvious. So, where do we see Elijah's suffering prophesied in the Old Testament? Well, we see that he did suffer on this earth, Elijah did, so much so that he despaired of his life. We see that in 1 Kings chapter 19. We might recall also that the people, or that certain people, wanted to kill Elijah, especially Jezebel, King Ahab's wife and queen. Now, do we see any parallels between that, what happened there, what we read in Mark chapter 6, with Herodias having John the Baptist killed, the wife of the king? Do we see any parallels there? I think we do. I think we do. Remember, in Mark 6, we read of this event, of this queen, Herodias, wanting to kill John, and this time succeeding. While this was not a prophecy in the conventional sense, it is in the typical sense. That is, Elijah being a type of John the Baptist. We see that there. So that's what I have on this section. I don't think we'll have time to get into the next, but Sam, if you have any comments, or anybody else on the live stream have any comments, before we can read the next section maybe and look at the and move on just a little bit before we close out, unless you have some comments, anything that you'd like to say.
You made the point, I think, last week when we were talking about this, that this is one of the values of having the different accounts. Is, you know, it makes it really clear in Matthew. He says, "This is John the Baptist," you know, so they can tell it. And, you know, God's going to provide us through the means that He has with what we need to know. And so we don't have any trouble looking back at it now and saying, "Yep, this is, they're talking about John the Baptist, and he was, you know, in the spirit and power of Elijah," as it says in the things before. And, you know, we understand all that, but boy, they sure didn't. I think that's the thing that, you know, we got to cut them some slack. They didn't know what was going to happen the next day. We look back at it. We know, we've read the story and heard it our whole lives. And to not know that there was not something else, or that, you know, Jesus was going to bring the kingdom right then, and they were going to all be generals in a new Israeli a new country, you know, without the Romans. I mean, they didn't know any of that.
Yeah, that's right. So there's just so much that that they didn't know, and we always have to recognize that, again, we're looking at things in hindsight. We have that benefit. And we have to, in order to understand these people, sometimes we have to put ourselves in their shoes so that we can know, or at least identify with them and understand, hey, these are real people. These aren't demigods, if you will. These aren't great people who are any greater or worse than you or me. These are people who are trying to do their best, trying to understand what's going on here, and follow after the Lord. Now, they all had different personalities, as we note. Peter is certainly one of the more outspoken ones. And so there is that aspect of it as well. And I'm, for one, grateful for the different personalities that they all bring to this, And in some ways, I kind of wish we could see other aspects of that with the other disciples as well. We don't have a whole lot on the rest, but it is good to look at all that. All right, so we have about 5 minutes left. Let's see if I can get through this next section, maybe. Maybe. All right, so next we're going to look at healing and epileptic. And so let's look at, again, verse or chapter 9. Let's remove me for a second. Chapter 9. And then the next miracle on here, we've looked at healing the blind man there in chapter 8. And this next one is the third to the last that Jesus performed, specific miracle that he performed, and this in the Gospel of Mark anyway. And this is healing an epileptic. It's recorded in both Matthew and Luke. All right. There we go. Healing an epileptic. So let's look at that. And let's bring me back. Capture. All right. Healing this epileptic, we'll see in. This is a long chapter or a long section, so we're not going to be able to get through all of it by any means. Let's look at the first five verses, 14 through 18. And when he came to the disciples, he saw a great multitude around them, and scribes disputing with them. Immediately, when they saw him, all the people were greatly amazed, and running to him, greeted him. And he asked the scribes, "What are you discussing with them?" Then one of the crowd answered and said, "Teacher, I brought you my son who has a mute spirit, and wherever it seizes him, it throws him down. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. So I spoke to your disciples that they should cast it out, but they could not." So there's a lot going on here, and it kind of overlaps. Some of this information overlaps, but we're looking at these first five verses to consider what's going on here. That there is a dispute that is happening at this time, a dispute, and it seems to me that while Jesus and the three disciples, of course Peter, James, and John, were on this high mountain, we're not sure exactly where it was. It could have been Mount Tabor, it could have been Mount Hermon, it could have been well, it could have been some other mountain that we just don't know. And a dispute arose during this time. A dispute arose between the remaining disciples, remaining nine disciples, and the scribes. There was this conflict between the two groups. If the Mount of Transfiguration happened on what was on Mount Tabor, then it would, then it, this could be anywhere. Around that particular mountain. There are modern day villages around there. Who knows what villages existed at that time? I mean, there might be some evidence, but I haven't found any about that exact thing. In any event, if this is Mount Hermon, then this is likely, very likely, Caesarea Philippi that these things are happening in. So we're back in Caesarea Philippi. The disciples spent 6 days there at least. And so they are. This man comes with his son to have his son healed. The people, amazingly, it says the people were greatly amazed in verse 15. All the people were greatly amazed and running to him greeted him. They seem to be greatly amazed when they see Jesus. Some have speculated that Jesus was still glowing after this transfiguration experience, much like Moses was glowing after he had come down the mount, come down the mountain, come down Mount Sinai. You know, maybe that's true, maybe not. As I said, it's speculation. It doesn't say whether or not that happened. In any event, based on the information that we have, here's what I think happened while they were away. Now, I'm not speaking as to the glowing aspect, but here's what I think happened while Jesus and the three were away. The father of this demon-possessed boy recognizes the disciples, recognizes the nine that are milling about somewhere. I don't know what they're doing, but they're about, and he recognizes them. He knows that they have the ability to heal. Remember, Jesus had given them this power all the way back in chapter 6, verse 7, and we also see this in verse 13, that they were healing people. They were casting out demons, things of that nature. Desperate, he begs them to heal his son. They try, but they are unable to do so. The scribes notice this inability, and now think that they've got Jesus. They've got his number. They've figured it out. They had been looking, after all, they had been looking for any opportunity to bring him down. And now, finally, they have something, some shred of imperfection. Or so they think. Or so they think. As a result, they argue with the disciples. And here's, in my head, how it would play out. Ha! You think you have the power of God, but you can't even do this. But the disciples say, but we've done this many times. We're not sure why we're not able to do this at this time. Ha! Yeah, right. Everyone, look at these charlatans, and so on. And of course, the scribes, during all this, they're not caring about the plight of this man and his son. And then Jesus arrives, and he asks what's going on. Some manuscripts say they instead of he, as saying, and when they came to the disciples, they saw a great multitude around them. Some manuscripts say they instead of he in that verse, in verse 14. And that indicates, of course, Jesus, Peter, James, and John. They had come to the other nine. And to me, this makes the most sense, since even in the other accounts, it occurs right after the transfiguration. So the four would be together approaching this dispute, what was happening here. And then, of course, we see this in the other parallel accounts in Matthew 17:14 and Luke 9:37. And then we get to the problem, which we will get to next week. Thank you for joining us. Any other comments or questions before we close this out and go to our evening worship live stream? All right. Very good. We'll get to that in just a moment. Stick around. We will be ending this live stream and start a new one in a moment. We'll send off the link to everybody, so anybody in the congregation. And if you're not a member of this particular congregation, then you can refresh that button, or perhaps you'll get a notification of it in a little while. So again, thank you all for joining us here today. God bless you. We will see you in just a moment.